I stuck to my story. Out of fear, and to keep up appearances, perhaps, I repeated the same lies I'd told you. This may well have made it more difficult for you to investigate the incident, and may have somewhat distorted your conclusions. No, I know it did. This has bothered me for years, and I'm ashamed of what I did. I hope this explains why I've written this long letter to you. I realize you're a busy man and may not have time for this. If so, please feel free to treat it all as the ramblings of an old woman and toss the letter away. The thing is, I feel the need, while I'm still able, to confess all that really took place then. Write it down and pass it along to someone who should know. I recovered from my illness, but you never know when there might be a relapse. I hope you will take this into consideration. The night before I took the children up into the hills, I had a dream about my husband, just before dawn. He had been drafted and was off at war. The dream was extremely realistic and sexually charged, one of those dreams that's so vivid it's hard to distinguish between dream and reality. In the dream, we were lying on a large, flat rock, having sex. It was a light grey rock near the top of a mountain. The whole thing was about the size of two tatami mats, the surface smooth and damp. It was cloudy and looked as though we were about to have a storm, but there wasn't any wind. It seemed near twilight, and birds were hurrying off to their nests. So there the two of us were, under that cloudy sky, silently having intercourse. We hadn't been married long at this time, and the war had separated us. My body was burning for my husband. I felt an indescribable pleasure. We tried all sorts of positions and did it over and over, climaxing again and again. It's strange now that I think of it, for in real life the two of us were calm, rather introverted people. We'd never given in to our passions like this or experienced such soaring pleasure. In the dream, though, for the first time in our lives, we'd thrown away all restraints and were going at it like animals. When I opened my eyes, it was still dim outside, and I felt very odd. My body felt heavy, and I could still feel my husband deep inside me. My heart was pounding, and I found it hard to breathe. My vagina was wet, just like after intercourse. It felt as if I'd really made love and not just dreamed it. I'm embarrassed to say it, but I masturbated at this point. I was burning with lust and had to do something to calm down. Afterwards, I rode my bike to school as usual and escorted the children on our field trip to Owanyama. As we walked up the mountain path, I could still feel the lingering effects of sex. All I had to do was close my eyes, and I could feel my husband coming inside me, his semen shooting against the wall of my womb. I'd clung to him for all I was worth, my legs spread as wide as possible, my ankles entangled with his thighs. I was, frankly, in a daze as I took the children up the hill. I felt as if I was still in the middle of that realistic, erotic dream. We climbed up the mountain, reached the spot we were aiming at, and just as the children were getting ready to fan out to hunt for mushrooms, my period suddenly started. It wasn't time for it. My last one had stopped only 10 days before, and my periods were always regular. Perhaps this erotic dream had stirred something up inside me and set it off. Naturally, I hadn't come prepared, and here we were in the hills, far from town. I told the children to take a short break. Then I went off alone into the woods and took care of myself as best I could with a couple of towels I had with me. There was a great deal of blood, and it made quite a mess, but I was sure I'd be able to manage until we made it back to school. My head was a complete blank, and I couldn't focus at all. I had a guilty conscience, I imagine, about that uninhibited dream, about masturbating, and about having sexual fantasies in front of the children. I was the type who usually suppressed those kinds of thoughts. I had the children go off to gather their mushrooms and was thinking we'd better make it a short trip and go back as soon as we could. Once at school, I'd be able to clean up better. I sat down and watched the children as they hunted for mushrooms. I kept a head count and made sure none of them were out of my sight. After a while, though, I noticed one little boy walking towards me with something in his hands. It was the boy named Nakata, the same boy who didn't regain consciousness and was hospitalized. He was holding the bloody towels I'd used. I gasped and couldn't believe my eyes. I'd hidden them far away, out of sight, where the children wouldn't go. You have to understand that this is the most embarrassing thing for a woman, something you don't want anybody else to see. How he was able to unearth them, I have no idea. Before I realized what I was doing, I was slapping him. I grabbed him by the shoulders and was slapping him hard on the cheeks. I might have been yelling something, I don't recall. I was out of control, no longer in my right mind. I think the embarrassment must have been so great I was in shock. I'd never, ever struck one of the children before. But it wasn't me who was doing it. And then I noticed all the children there, staring at me. Some were standing, some sitting, all of them looking at me. It was all right in front of them. Me, pale, standing there. Nakata collapsed on the ground from all the blows, the bloody towels. It was a moment frozen in time. Nobody moved. Nobody said a word. The children were expressionless, their faces like bronze masks. A great silence descended on the woods. All you could hear were the birds chirping. I can't get that scene out of my mind. I don't know how much time passed. Perhaps not so very long, but it seemed like forever. Time driving me to the very edge of the world. Eventually, I snapped out of it. Color had returned to the world around me. I hid the bloody towels behind me and lifted Nakata up from where he lay. I held him tight and apologized to him as best I could. I was wrong. Please, please forgive me, I begged him. He looked as though he was still in shock. His eyes were blank, and I don't think he could hear what I said. With him still in my arms, I turned to the other children and told them to go on with their mushroom hunting. They probably couldn't comprehend what had just taken place. It was all too strange, too sudden. I stood there for a while, holding Nakata tight in my arms, feeling like I wanted to die or disappear. Just over the horizon, the violence of war went on, with countless people dying. I no longer had any idea what was right and what was wrong. Was I really seeing the real world? Was the sound of birds I was hearing real? I found myself alone in the woods, utterly confused, blood flowing freely from my womb. I was angry, afraid, embarrassed. All of these rolled into one. I cried, I remember, without making a sound. And that's when the children collapsed. I wasn't going to tell the military people what had really happened. It was wartime, and we had to keep up appearances. So I left out the part about my period starting, about Nakata finding the bloody towels, and me hitting him. Again, I'm afraid this threw an obstacle in your path as you investigated the incident. You can't imagine how relieved I am to finally get it off my chest. Oddly enough, none of the children had any memory of the incident. Nobody remembered the bloody towels or me beating Nakata. Those memories had fallen away completely from their minds. Later, soon after the incident, I was able indirectly to sound out each child and confirm that this was indeed the case. Perhaps the mass coma had already started by then. I'd like to say a few things about young Nakata as his former teacher. What happened to him after the incident, I don't really know. When I was interviewed after the war, the American officer told me he'd been taken to a hospital in Tokyo and eventually regained consciousness. He wouldn't give me any details, though. I imagine that you know more about this than I do, Professor. Nakata was one of the five children evacuated to our town, and of the five, he was the brightest and had the best grades. He had very pleasant features and always dressed well. He was a gentle boy and never butted in where he didn't belong. Never once in class did he volunteer an answer, but when I called on him, he would always give the correct response. And when I asked his opinion, he'd give a logical reply. He caught on right away, no matter what the subject. Every class has a student like that. One who'll study what he needs to without supervision, who you know will one day go on to a top university and get an excellent job. A child who's innately capable. As his teacher, though, there were a couple of things about him that bothered me. Every so often I felt a sense of resignation in him. Even when he did well on difficult assignments, he never seemed happy. He never struggled to succeed, never seemed to experience the pain of trial and error. He never sighed or cracked a smile. It was as if these were things he had to get through, so he just did them. He efficiently handled whatever came his way, like a factory worker. Screwdriver in hand, working on a conveyor belt, tightening a screw on each part that comes down the line. I never met his parents, so I can't be certain, but there had to be a problem at home. I'd met a number of cases like this. Adults are forever raising the bar on clever children, precisely because they're able to handle it. The children get overwhelmed by the tasks they are set, and gradually lose the sort of openness and sense of accomplishment they naturally have. When they're treated like that, children start to crawl inside a shell and keep everything inside. It takes a lot of time and effort to get them to open up again. Kids' hearts are malleable, but once they gel, it's hard to get them back the way they were, next to impossible in most cases. But maybe I shouldn't be giving my opinions on the matter. This is, after all, your area of expertise. I also sensed a hint of violence in the boy's background. Sometimes there'd be a flash of fear in his eyes that seemed an instinctive reaction to long-term exposure to violence. What level of violence this was, I had no way of knowing. Nakata was a very self-disciplined child and good at hiding his fear. But there'd be the occasional involuntary flinch, ever so slight, that he couldn't cover up. I knew that something violent had taken place in his home. When you spend a lot of time with children, you pick up on these things. Rural families can be pretty violent. Most of the parents are farmers, all of them struggling to make ends meet. They're exhausted, doing back-breaking work from morning to night, and when they have a bit to drink and get angry, they're liable to strike out physically. It's no secret this kind of thing goes on, and most of the time the farm children take it in their stride and survive with no emotional scars. But Nakata's father was a university professor, and his mother, from what I could gather from the letters she sent me, was a well-educated woman. An upper-middle-class urban family, in other words. If there was any violence taking place in a family like that, it was bound to be something more complicated and less direct than what farm kids experience. The kind of violence a child keeps wrapped up inside himself. That's why I so regretted slapping him on the mountain that day, whether I did it unconsciously or not. I should never have behaved in that way, and I've felt guilty and ashamed ever since. I regret it even more since Nakata, after being dragged away from his parents and placed in an unfamiliar environment, was finally on the verge of opening up to me before the incident. The kind of violence I displayed then may very well have dealt a fatal blow to whatever feelings had been budding inside him. I was hoping for an opportunity to repair the harm I'd caused, but circumstances dictated otherwise. Still unconscious, Nakata was taken to hospital in Tokyo, and I never saw him again. It's something I regret to this day. I can still see the look on his face as I was slapping him. The tremendous fear and resignation he was feeling. I'm sorry. I didn't plan to write such a long letter. But there is one more thing I have to mention. To tell the truth, when my husband died in the Philippines, just before the end of the war, it wasn't that much of a shock. I didn't feel any despair or anger, just a deep sense of helplessness. I didn't cry at all. I already knew that somewhere, on some distant battlefield, my husband would lose his life. Ever since the year before, when all those things I just wrote about took place, that erotic dream, my period starting ahead of time, hitting Nakata, the children falling into that mysterious coma, I'd accepted my husband's death as inevitable, as something fated to be. So news of his death merely confirmed what I already knew. The whole experience on the hill was beyond anything I've ever experienced. I feel as though I left a part of my soul in those woods. In closing, I'd like to express my hope that your research will continue to flourish. Please take good care of yourself. Sincerely yours.
13. It's after 12, and I'm eating lunch and gazing at the garden, when Oshima comes out and sits next to me. Today I pretty much have the library to myself. As always, my lunch is the cheapest box lunch from the little shop at the train station. We talk for a while, and Oshima urges half his sandwiches on me. "I made extra today just for you," he insists. "Don't take it the wrong way. But you look as if you're not eating." "I'm trying to make my stomach shrink," I explain. "On purpose?" he asks. I nod. "You're doing that to save money?" Again, I nod. "I can understand that. But at your age, you need to fill up whenever you get the chance. You need your nutrition." The sandwich he's offering me looks delicious. I thank him and start eating. Smoked salmon, watercress, and lettuce on soft white bread. The crust is nicely crunchy, and horseradish and butter complete the sandwich. "Did you make this yourself?" I ask. "No one's going to make it for me," he says. He pours black coffee from his thermos into a mug, while I drink milk from a small carton. "What are you reading these days?" "Natsume Soseki's complete works," I say. I still hadn't read some of his novels, so this is a great chance to read them all. "You like him enough to want to read everything he wrote?" Oshima asks. I nod. Steam's rising from the cup in his hand. It's dark and cloudy outside, but at least the rain stopped. "Which of his novels have you read since you came here?" "I've finished The Miner, and now I'm on Poppies." "The Miner, eh?" Oshima says, apparently searching out a vague memory of the book. "That's the story of a college student from Tokyo who ends up working in a mine, isn't it? And he goes through all these tough times with the other miners before returning to the world outside. A sort of medium-length novel, as I recall. I read it a long time ago. The plot isn't what you'd normally expect from Soseki, and the style's kind of unpolished, too. Not one of his best. What do you like about it?" I try putting into words my impressions of the novel. But I need Crow's help. Need him to appear from wherever he is, spread his wings wide, and search out the right words for me. "The main character's from a rich family," I say. but he has an affair that goes sour, and he gets depressed and runs away from home. While he's wandering around, this shady character comes up to him and asks him to work in a mine, and he just tags along after him and finds himself working in the Asheo mine. He's way down underground, going through all kinds of experiences he never could have imagined. This innocent rich boy finds himself crawling around in the dregs of society. I sip my milk and try to piece together the rest of what I want to say. It takes a while before Crow comes back, but Oshima waits patiently. Those are life-and-death type experiences he goes through in the mines. Eventually he gets out and goes back to his old life. But nothing in the novel shows he learned anything from these experiences, that his life changed, that he thought deeply now about the meaning of life, or started questioning society or anything else. You don't get any sense either that he's matured. You have a strange feeling after you finish the book. It's as if you wonder, what was Soseki trying to say? It's as if not really knowing what he's getting at is the part that stays with you. I can't explain it very well. So, the miners structured very differently from, say, Soseki's Sanshiro, your typical modern Bildungsroman. I nod. I don't know about that, but you might be right. Sanshiro grows up in the story, runs into obstacles, ponders things, overcomes difficulties, right? But the hero of the miners different. All he does is watch things happen and accept it all. I mean, every now and again he gives his own opinions, but nothing very deep. Instead, he just broods over his love affair. He comes out of the mine pretty much the same as when he went in. He has no sense that it was something he decided to do himself, or that he had a choice. He's totally passive. But I think in real life people are like that. It's not so easy to make choices on your own. Do you see yourself as like the hero of the miner? I shake my head. No, I never thought of it that way. But people need to cling to something, Oshima says. They have to. You're doing the same, even though you don't realize it. It's as Goethe said. Everything's a metaphor. I mull this over for a while. Oshima takes a sip of coffee. At any rate, that's an interesting take on the miner. Particularly since you're both runaways. Makes me want to read it again. I finish the sandwich, crush the now empty milk carton, and toss it in the rubbish bin. Oshima, I say, deciding to come right out with it. I'm in a bit of a fix, and you're the only one I can ask for advice. He opens both hands wide with a go-right-ahead gesture. It's a long story, but I don't have anywhere to stay tonight. I've got a sleeping bag, so I don't need a futon or bed or anything, just a roof over my head. Do you know of any place around here like that? I'm guessing that you're not thinking of a hotel or inn. I shake my head. Money's a factor, but I'm also hoping not to be too conspicuous. To the juvenile department of the police, I bet. Yeah. Oshima thinks it over for a time and says, well, you could stay here. In the library? Sure. It has a roof and a vacant room, too, that nobody uses at night. But do you think it's all right? Of course we'll have to make some arrangements first. But it is possible. Or not impossible, I should say. I'm sure I can manage it. How so? You like to read good books, to work things out on your own. You look like you're in good shape physically, and you're an independent kind of guy. You like to lead a well-regulated life and have a lot of willpower. I mean, even the willpower to make your stomach smaller, right? I'll talk with Miss Saeki about you becoming my assistant and staying in the empty room here at the library. You want me to be your assistant? You won't have to do much, Oshima says. Basically, help me open and close the place. We hire professionals to do the heavy cleaning or to input things on the computer. Apart from that, there's not a whole lot to do. You can just read whatever you like. Sound good? Yeah, of course it does. I'm not sure what to say. But I don't think Miss Saeki's going to go for it. I'm only 15 and a runaway, which she doesn't know anything about. But Miss Saiki's... How should I put it? Oshima begins, then uncharacteristically comes to a halt, searching for the right word. A little different. Different. She has a different take on things from other people. I nod. A different take on things. What does that mean? You mean she's an unusual person? Oshima shakes his head. No, I wouldn't say that. If you're talking about unusual, that would be me. She just isn't bound by conventional ways of doing things. I'm still trying to figure out the difference between different and unusual, but decide to hold off asking any more questions, for the time being. After a pause, Oshima says, Staying here tonight, though, is a problem. So I'll take you someplace else, where you can stay for a couple of days till we get things settled. You don't mind, do you? It's a little far away. No problem, I tell him. The library closes at 5, Oshima says, and I have to straighten things up, so we'll leave around 5:30. I'll drive you there in my car. Nobody's staying there now, and not to worry, the place has a roof. I appreciate it. You can thank me after we get there. It might not be what you're imagining. I go back to the reading room and pick up where I left off in Poppy's. I'm not a fast reader to begin with. I like to linger over each sentence, enjoying the style. If I don't enjoy the writing, I stop. Just before 5, I finish the novel, put it back on the shelf, then sit back on the sofa, close my eyes, and think about what happened last night. About Sakura. About her room. What she did to me. All the twists and turns as events took their course. At 5:30, I'm standing outside the library waiting for Oshima. He leads me to the car park behind the library, and we get into his green sports car, a Mazda Miata with the top down. My backpack's too big for the little boot, so we tie it down tight on the rear rack. It's a long drive, so we'll stop along the way for dinner, Oshima says. He turns the ignition key and starts up the engine. Where are we headed? Kochi, he replies. Ever been there? I shake my head. How far is it? It'll take us about 2.5 hours to get where we're going. Towards the south, over the mountains. You don't mind going so far? It's okay. It's a straight run, and it's still light out. And I've got a full tank. We drive through the twilight city streets, then join the highway heading west. Oshima changes lanes smoothly, slipping in between other cars, effortlessly shifting gears. Each time the hum of the engine changes slightly. When he shifts gears and floors it, the little car's soon zipping along at more than 90. The car's specially tuned, so it's got a lot of pickup. This isn't your ordinary Miata. Do you know much about cars? I shake my head. Cars are definitely not my speciality. Do you enjoy driving? I ask. The doctor made me give up all risky sports, so instead I drive. Compensation. Is something wrong with you? The medical name's pretty long, but it's a type of hemophilia, Oshima says casually. Do you know what that is? I think so, I say. I learned about it in biology class. Once you start bleeding, you can't stop. It's genetic, where the blood doesn't coagulate. That's right. There's all kinds of hemophilia, and the type I have is pretty rare. It's not such a bad type of the disease, but I have to be careful not to get injured. Once I start bleeding, I have to go to the hospital. Besides, these days there are problems with the blood supply in hospitals. Dying a slow death from AIDS isn't an option for me. So I've made some connections in town to supply me with safe blood, just in case. Because of my disease, I don't go on long journeys. Except for regular checkups at the university hospital in Hiroshima, I rarely leave town. It's not so bad, though. I never did like traveling or sports all that much anyway. I can't use a kitchen knife, so doing any real cooking's out, which is a shame. Driving's a risky enough sport, I tell him. It's a different kind of risk. Whenever I drive, I try to go as fast as I can. If I'm in an accident driving fast, I won't only end up getting a cut finger. If you lose a lot of blood, there's no difference between a hemophiliac and anybody else. It evens things out, since your chances of survival are the same. You don't have to worry about things like blood coagulation or anything, and can die without any regrets. I see. Don't worry, Oshima laughs. I'm not going to have an accident. I'm a careful driver and don't push it. I keep my car in tip-top condition, too. Besides, when I die, I want to die peacefully all by myself. Taking someone else with you, then, isn't an option either. Got it in one. We pull into a rest stop restaurant for dinner. I have chicken and a salad. He orders the seafood curry and a salad. Just something to fill our stomachs is the best you could say about it. Oshima pays the bill, and we climb into the car again. It's already dark. He steps on the accelerator, and the speedometer shoots way up. Do you mind if I put on some music? Oshima asks. Of course not, I reply. He pushes the CD play button, and some classical piano music starts. I listen for a while, trying to place the music. I know it's not Beethoven, and not Schumann. Probably somebody who came in between. Schubert, I ask. Good guess, he replies. His hands at 10-2 on the steering wheel, he glances over at me. Do you like Schubert? Not especially, I tell him. When I drive, I like to listen to Schubert's piano sonatas with the volume turned up. Do you know why? I have no idea. Because playing Schubert's piano sonatas well is one of the hardest things in the world. Most of all, this sonata in D major. It's a tough piece to master. Some pianists can play one or maybe two of the movements perfectly. But if you listen to all four movements as a unified whole, no one has ever nailed it. A lot of famous pianists have risen to the challenge, but it's as if there's always something missing. There's never one where you can say, yes, he's got it. Do you know why? No, I reply. Because the sonata itself is imperfect. Robert Schumann understood Schubert's sonatas well, and he labelled this one heavenly tedious. If the composition's imperfect, why would so many pianists try to master it? Good question, Oshima says, and pauses as music fills in the silence. I have no great explanation for it, but one thing I can say, works that have a certain imperfection to them have an appeal for that very reason. Or at least they appeal to certain types of people, just like you're attracted to Soseki's The Minor. There's something in it that draws you in, more than more fully realized novels like Kokoro or Sanshiro. You discover something about that work that tugs at your heart. Or maybe we should say that the work discovers you. Schubert's Sonata in D Major is like that. To get back to the question, I say, why do you listen to Schubert's sonatas, particularly when you're driving? If you play Schubert's sonatas, especially this one, straight through, it's not art. As Schumann pointed out, it's too long and too pastoral, and technically too simplistic. Play it through the way it is, and it's flat and tasteless, some dusty antique. Which is why every pianist who attempts it adds something of his own, something extra. Like this. Hear how he articulates it there. Adding rubato. Adjusting the pace, modulation, whatever. Otherwise they can't hold it all together. They have to be careful, though, or else all those extra devices destroy the dignity of the piece. And then it's not Schubert's music anymore. Every single pianist who's played this D major sonata struggles with the same paradox. He listens to the music, humming the melody, then continues. That's why I like to listen to Schubert while I'm driving. As I said, it's because all the performances are imperfect. A dense, artistic imperfection stimulates your consciousness, keeps you alert. If I listen to some utterly perfect performance of an utterly perfect piece while I'm driving, I might want to close my eyes and die right then and there. But listening to the D major, I can feel the limits of what humans are capable of. That a certain type of perfection can only be realized through a limitless accumulation of the imperfect. And personally, I find that encouraging. Do you see what I'm getting at? Sort of. I'm sorry, Oshima says. I tend to get carried away on the subject. But there's all sorts and degrees of imperfection, right? I say. Sure, of course. Comparatively speaking, which performance of the D major sonata do you think's the best? That's a tough one. Oshima gives it some thought. He shifts down, swings into the outside lane, slips swiftly past a huge refrigerated 18-wheeler, shifts up and steers back into our lane. Not to frighten you, but a green Miata is one of the hardest vehicles to spot on the highway at night. It has such a low profile, plus the green tends to blend into the darkness. Lorry drivers especially can't see it from up in their cabs. It can be a risky business, particularly in tunnels. Sports cars really should all be red. Then they'd stand out. That's why most Ferraris are red. But I happen to like green, even if it makes things more dangerous. Green's the colour of a forest. Red's the colour of blood. He glances at his watch and goes back to humming along with the music. Generally, I'd have to say Brendel and Ashkenazi give the best performances, though they don't do anything for me emotionally. Schubert's is music that challenges and shatters the ways of the world. That's the essence of Romanticism, and Schubert's music is the epitome of the Romantic. I keep on listening to the sonata. "What do you think? Boring?" he asks. "Kind of," I admit. You can appreciate Schubert if you train yourself. I was the same way when I first listened to him. It bored me silly. It's only natural for someone your age. You'll appreciate it in time. People soon get tired of things that aren't boring, but not of what is boring. What's that all about? For me, I might have the leisure to be bored, but not to grow tired of something. Most people can't distinguish between the two. You said you're an unusual person. Do you mean because of the haemophilia? That's part of it, he says, and gives this devilish smile. There's more to it than that. Schubert's long, heavenly sonata finishes, and we don't listen to any more music. We fall silent, each of us filling in the silence with our own random thoughts. I gaze vacantly at the passing signs. At a junction we turn south, and the road heads into the mountains, one long tunnel after another. Oshima concentrates hard each time he passes another vehicle. We go by a number of slow-moving lorries on the road, and every time there's this whooshing moan of air, as though somebody's soul is being yanked out. From time to time, I look back to make sure my backpack's still tied down okay. The place we're headed is deep in the mountains, not the most pleasant dwelling in the world, Oshima says. I doubt you'll see anybody else while you're there. There's no radio, TV or phone. Sure you don't mind? I don't, I reply. You're used to being alone, Oshima comments. I nod. But solitude comes in different varieties. What's waiting for you might be a little unexpected. In what way? Oshima pushes up the bridge of his glasses. I can't really say. It might change depending on you. We get off the highway and start down a smaller road. Along a side road near the exit, there's a small town. Oshima stops at a small shop and buys almost more groceries than we can carry. Vegetables and fruit, biscuits, milk and mineral water, tinned goods, bread, packet instant food, mostly things that don't require much cooking. I reach for my wallet, but he shakes his head and pays for it all. Back in the sports car, we drive on down the road. I'm holding the bags that wouldn't fit into the boot. Once we leave the little town, everything is dark around us. No houses, and only the occasional car. The road's so narrow it's hard for two cars to pass by each other. Oshima flips the lights to full beam and races ahead, braking, accelerating, shifting from second to third and back. His expression is fixed as he focuses on driving, lips tight, eyes riveted on a point up ahead in the darkness, right hand clutching the top of the wheel, left hand poised for action on the gear stick knob. A sharp bluff appears on our left side. It looks as though there's a mountain stream down below. The curves get sharper, the road more slippery, and a couple of times the rear end of the car spins, but I decide not to worry about it. As far as Oshima is concerned, having an accident here most likely isn't an option. My watch shows a little before 9. I crack open my window and let the cold air rush in. Everything sounds different here. We're in the mountains, heading in deeper. I breathe a sigh of relief when the road finally cuts away from the bluffs and turns into a forest. Trees soar magically above us. Our headlights lick at the trunks, illuminating one after another. We've left the tarmac road behind, the tyres squirting out pebbles that ricochet against the bottom of the car. The suspension dances up and down over the rough road. There's no moon, no stars. A fine rain occasionally splashes against the windscreen. "Do you come here a lot?" I ask. "I used to. Now with the job and everything, I can't come so often. My older brother's a surfer and lives on the shore in Kochi. He runs a surf shop there and makes surfboards. He comes here sometimes. Do you surf?" "Never tried it," I tell him. "If you have the chance, you should have my brother teach you. He's very good," Oshima says. "If you meet him, you'll see he's not at all like me. He's big, tanned, kind of quiet, not so sociable, and likes beer. And wouldn't know Schubert from Wagner. But we get on really well." We continue down the road through thick woods, and finally turn off. Oshima stops the car and, leaving the engine running, climbs out and unlocks a kind of wire fence and pushes it open. We drive inside and proceed down another windy, bumpy road into a clearing where the road ends. Oshima stops the car, sighs heavily, and brushes his hair back with both hands, then kills the engine and puts on the handbrake. The cooling fan still hums, cooling off the overheated engine as steam rises from the hood. But with the engine off, a heavy stillness falls over us. I hear a small stream nearby, the faint sound of water. High above us, the wind rustles symbolically. I open the door and step outside. Patches of chill hang in the air. I have on a yachting jacket over my t-shirt and zip it up to my neck. There's a small building in front of us, a log cabin by the look of it, though it's too dark to see much. Only a dark outline floating against the background of the forest. The headlights still on, Oshima slowly approaches the cabin, torch in hand, walks up the porch steps, takes out a key and unlocks the door. He goes inside, strikes a match and lights a lamp. He then steps out onto the porch, holding the lamp, and announces, "Welcome to my house." It all looks like a drawing in an old storybook. I walk up the steps and go inside. Oshima lights a larger lamp hanging from the ceiling. The cabin consists of a single, big, boxy room. There's a small bed in the corner, a dining table, and two wooden chairs, a tired sofa, a hopelessly faded rug, bits of old furniture nobody wanted, it looks like, just thrown together. There's a breeze block and board shelf crammed full of books, their covers worn like they've been read a lot. There's also an old chest for storing clothes, and a simple kitchen with a work surface, a small gas stove, and sink, but no running water. Instead, an aluminium pail, I guess, is for water. A pan and kettle on a shelf, plus a frying pan hanging from the wall. And in the middle of the room, there's a black wood-burning stove. My brother built this cabin almost all by himself. He took the original rough lumberjack hut and remodeled it. He's good with his hands. I was still quite little then, and helped out a bit, making sure I didn't get cut or anything. It's quite primitive. No electricity, no running water, no toilet. The only modern convenience is the propane gas. Oshima pours some mineral water into the kettle and sets it to boil. My grandfather originally owned this mountain. He was a wealthy man in Kochi, with a lot of property. He passed away 10 years ago, and my brother and I inherited almost the entire mountain. No other relatives wanted it. It's too far off the beaten track, and not worth much. If you were going to keep it for harvesting trees, you'd have to hire people, and it'd cost too much. I open the curtain at the window. All I can see, though, is a wall of total darkness. "When I was just about your age," Oshima says, dipping chamomile tea bags into a pot, "I used to come here a lot and live on my own. Not see anybody else, not talk to anybody. My brother almost forced me to. Usually, with somebody who has a disease like mine, you wouldn't do that. Too dangerous for them to be alone in some isolated spot. But my brother didn't worry about that." He leans back against the worktop, waiting for the water to boil. "He wasn't trying to discipline me or anything. It's just what he believed I needed. Looking back on it, I can see it was a good experience, something I did need. I could read a lot, think things over. To tell you the truth, after a certain period I rarely went to school. School and I had a mutual hate relationship. I was different from everybody else. Out of the kindness of their hearts, they let me graduate from junior high. But after that, I was on my own, basically. Just like you. Did I already tell you all this? I shake my head. Is that why you're being so nice to me? That's part of it, he says, then pauses. But that's not the whole reason. Oshima passes me a cup of tea and sips at his own. My nerves are tense after the long drive, and the chamomile is just what I need to calm down. Oshima glances at his watch. I'd better be going, so let me explain everything. There's a nice stream nearby you can use for water. It's spring-fed, so you can drink it as it is. Much better than these bottles of mineral water. There's firewood stacked up at the back, so use the stove if you get cold. It gets pretty chilly here. I've even used it a few times in August. The stove you can use for simple cooking. If you need any other tools or anything, check the tool shed out the back. And feel free to wear any old clothes of my brother's you find in the chest of drawers. He doesn't care if anybody wears his things. Oshima rests his hands on his hips and gives the cabin a once-over. It's not a romantic getaway, that's for sure. For simple living, though, it'll do. One thing I've got to warn you about. Don't go very far into the woods. The forest is really dense, and there's not a good path through it. Always keep the cabin in sight. It's easy to get lost if you go any further, and it's difficult finding your way back. I had a terrible experience there once. I was only a couple of hundred yards from the cabin, but spent half the day going in circles. You might think Japan's a small country, and there's no chance you could get lost in a forest. But once you get lost in these woods, believe me, you stay lost. I file that away for future reference. And except in an emergency, I wouldn't come down off the mountain. It's too far to any other houses. Wait here, and I'll be back in a couple of days to pick you up. You have enough food to see you through? By the way, do you have a mobile phone? I do, I tell him, pointing at my backpack. He grins at me. Keep it in your pack. It won't work here. No network. And of course the radio won't work either. You're cut off from the world. You should be able to get a lot of reading done. I suddenly think of a very practical question. If there's no toilet, where should I go? Oshima spreads both hands wide. The forest is all yours. It's up to you.
14. Nakata visited the vacant plot of land for several days. One morning it rained heavily, so he spent the day doing simple woodworking in his room, but apart from that he spent his time sitting in the weeds, waiting for the missing tortoiseshell cat to show up, or the man in the strange hat. But no luck. At the end of each day, Nakata stopped at the house of the people who'd hired him, and gave them an update on his search, where he'd gone, what sort of information he'd managed to pick up. The cat's owner would pay him 3,000 yen, his going rate. Nobody had ever officially set that fee. Word just got around that there was a master cat finder in the neighborhood, and somehow he settled on that daily rate. People would always give him something extra besides the money, food, sometimes clothes, and a bonus of 10,000 yen once he had actually tracked down the missing cat. Nakata wasn't constantly being asked to search for missing cats, so the fees he accumulated each month didn't add up to much. The older of his younger brothers paid his utilities out of the inheritance Nakata's parents had left him, which wasn't very much to begin with, and he lived on his meager savings and the municipal monthly subsidy for the elderly handicapped. He managed to get by on the subsidy alone, so his cat-finding fees he could spend as he wished, and for him it seemed a substantial amount. Sometimes, though, he couldn't come up with any idea of how to spend it, other than to enjoy his favourite grilled eel. Going to the bank or having a savings account at the post office involved filling out forms, so any leftover money he hid beneath the tatami in his room. Being able to converse with cats was Nakata's little secret. Only he and the cats knew about it. People would think he was crazy if he mentioned it, so he never did. Everybody knew he wasn't very bright, but being dumb and being crazy were different matters altogether. Sometimes people would walk by when he was deep in conversation with a cat, but they never seemed to care. It wasn't so unusual, after all, to see old people talking to animals as if they were people. But if anyone did happen to comment on his abilities with cats and say something like, "Mr. Nakata, how are you able to know cats' habits so well? It's almost like you can converse with them," he just smiled and let it pass. Nakata was always serious and well-mannered, with a pleasant smile, and was popular among the housewives in the neighborhood. His neat appearance also helped. Poor though he was, Nakata enjoyed bathing and doing laundry, and the nearly brand-new clothes his clients often gave him only added to his clean-cut look. Some of the clothes, a salmon-pink Jack Nicklaus golf shirt, for instance, didn't exactly suit him, but Nakata didn't mind as long as they were neat and clean. Nakata was standing at the front door, giving a halting report to his present client, Mrs. Koizumi, on the search for her cat, Goma. "Nakata finally has some information about little Goma," he began. "A person named Kawamura said that a few days ago he saw a cat resembling Goma over in the empty plot of land, the one with the wall around it, over in the Tuchome district. It's two big roads away from here, and he said the age, coat and collar are all the same as Goma's. Nakata decided to keep a lookout at the empty plot, so I take lunch and sit there every day, morning till sunset. No, don't worry about that. I have plenty of free time, so unless it's raining hard, I don't mind at all. But if you think it's no longer necessary, madam, for me to be on the lookout, then please tell me. I will stop right away." He didn't tell her that this Mr. Kawamura wasn't a person but a striped brown cat. That, he thought, would only complicate matters. Mrs. Koizumi thanked him. Her two little daughters were in a gloomy mood after their beloved pet suddenly vanished and had lost their appetite. Their mother couldn't just explain it away by telling them that cats tended to disappear every once in a while. Despite the shock to the girls, though, she didn't have the time to go around town looking for their cat. That made her all the more glad to find a person like Nakata who, for a mere 3,000 yen per diem, would do his best to search for Goma every day. Nakata was a strange old man and had a weird way of speaking, but people claimed he was an absolute genius when it came to tracking down cats. She knew she shouldn't think about it like this, but the old man didn't seem clever enough to deceive anyone. She handed him his fee in an envelope, as well as a Tupperware container with some vegetable rice and taro potatoes she'd just cooked. Nakata bowed as he took the Tupperware, sniffed the food, and thanked her. "Thank you kindly. Taro is one of Nakata's favorites." "I hope you enjoy it," Mrs. Koizumi replied. A week had passed since he first staked out the empty plot of land, during which time Nakata had seen a great many different cats come in and out. Kawamura, the brown-striped cat, stopped by a couple of times each day to say hello. Nakata greeted him, and they chatted about the weather and his sub-city. He still couldn't follow a word the cat said.
"Crouch on pavement, Kawara's in trouble," Kawamura said.
He seemed to want to convey something to Nakata, but the old man couldn't grasp it, and he said so. The cat seemed perplexed by this, and repeated the same, possibly the same, thought in different words.
"Kawara's shouting tide."
Nakata was even more lost.
"Too bad Mimi's not here to help out," he thought. "Mimi'd give the cat a good slap on the cheek and get him to make some sense. A smart cat, that Mimi."
But Mimi never showed up in a field like this, since she hated getting ticks from other cats. Once he'd spilled out all these ideas, which Nakata couldn't understand, Kawamura left, beaming. Other cats filtered in and out. At first they were on their guard when they spotted Nakata, staring at him in annoyance from a distance. But after they saw that he was just sitting there, doing nothing, they forgot all about him. In his typical, friendly way, Nakata tried to strike up conversations. He'd say hello and introduce himself, but most of the cats turned a deaf ear, pretending they couldn't hear him or looked right through him. The cats here were particularly adept at giving someone the cold shoulder.
They must have had some pretty awful experiences with humans, Nakata decided. He was in no position to demand anything of them, and didn't blame them for their standoffishness. He knew that in the world of cats, he would always be an outsider.
So you can talk, eh?
The cat, a black-and-white tabby with torn ears, said a bit hesitantly, glancing around. The cat spoke gruffly, but seemed nice enough.
Yes, a little, Nakata replied. Impressive all the same, the tabby observed. My name's Nakata, Nakata said, introducing himself. And your name would be?
I ain't got one, the tabby said brusquely.
How about Okawa? Do you mind if I call you that?
Whatever.
Well then, Mr. Okawa, Nakata said, as a token of our meeting each other, would you care for some dried sardines?
Sounds good. One of my favorite sardines. Nakata took a saran-wrapped sardine from his bag and opened it up for Okawa. He always had a few sardines with him, just in case. Okawa gobbled down the sardine, stripping it from head to tail, then cleaned his face.
That hit the spot. Much obliged. I'll be happy to lick you somewhere, if you like. No, there's no need. Nakata's grateful for the offer, but right now I don't need to be licked anywhere, thanks all the same. Actually, I've been asked by its owner to locate a missing cat, a female tortoiseshell by the name of Goma.
Nakata took the color snapshot of Goma from his bag and showed it to Okawa. Someone told me this cat has been spotted in this vacant plot of land, so Nakata's been sitting here for several days waiting for Goma to turn up.
So I was wondering if, by chance, you might have run across her.
Okawa glanced at the photo and made a gloomy face. Frown lines appeared between his eyebrows, and he blinked in consternation several times.
I'm grateful for the sardine, don't get me wrong. But I can't talk about that. I'll be in hot water if I do.
Nakata was bewildered.
In hot water if you talk about it? A dangerous, nasty business it is. I think you'd better write that cat off. And if you know what's good for you, you'll stay away from this place. I don't want you to get into trouble. Sorry I couldn't be of more help, but please consider this warning my way of thanking you for the food.
With this, Okawa stood up, looked around, and disappeared into a thicket. Nakata sighed, took out his thermos, and slowly sipped some tea. Okawa had said it was dangerous to be here, but Nakata couldn't imagine how. All he was doing was looking for a lost little cat. What could possibly be dangerous about that? Maybe it was that cat-catcher with the strange hat Kawamura told him about who's dangerous. But Nakata was a person, not a cat, so why should he be afraid of a cat-catcher? But the world was full of many things Nakata couldn't hope to fathom, so he gave up thinking about it. With a brain like his, the only result he got from thinking too much was a headache. Nakata sipped the last drop of his tea, screwed the cap on the thermos, and placed it back in his bag. After Okawa had disappeared into the thicket, no other cat showed up for a long time. Only butterflies, silently fluttering above the weeds. A flock of sparrows flew into the plot of land, scattered in various directions, regrouped and winged away. Nakata dozed off a few times, coming awake with a start. He knew approximately what time it was by the position of the sun. It was nearly evening when the dog walked over to where he was sitting. A huge, black dog, silently lumbering forward. From where Nakata sat, the beast looked more like a calf than a dog. It had long legs, short hair, bulging, steely muscles, ears as sharp as knife points, and no collar. Nakata didn't know much about breeds of dogs, but one glance told him this was the vicious variety, or at least one that could turn nasty if it had to. The kind of dog the military used in its K-9 corps. The dog's eyes were totally expressionless, and the skin around its mouth turned up, exposing wicked-looking fangs. Its teeth had blood on them, and slimy bits of meat were matted around its mouth. Its bright red tongue flicked out between its teeth like a flame. The dog fixed its glare on Nakata and stood there,
unmoving, without a sound, for a long time. Nakata was silent, too. He didn't know how to speak to dogs, only cats. The dog's eyes were as glazed and as lifeless as glass.